purpose of divine judgment of the world initially does not belong to the anthropological debate about the salvation of the soul or the body, but serves the realization of God's righteousness. The coming judgment makes man responsible for everything he does or fails to do. It compels him to identify himself completely with his present existence, for he will be judged according to his life here on earth. Since a man will have to give account of his life in its totality, this is why he will be raised from the dead in his totality, body and soul. So the father said, without a personal resurrection, a man could not identify himself in the transcendent judgment with his earthly life. And from the juridical logic of judgment, responsibility, and self-identification, the fathers drew the conclusion of the resurrection of the dead, and from this resurrection, in turn, the anthropological unity of man, body, and soul. In the anthropological debate of antiquity, between the idealism that teaches man to identify himself completely with his soul and the materialism that teaches man completely to identify himself with his body, Christianity introduced a new definition of man. He is a person in view of the coming judgment. Since he must give a total account of his life, he is compelled to identify himself completely with his life on earth. So body and soul are like cohorts of a gang brought to court, and therefore both can in turn also become co-heirs of salvation. It is indeed strange to see how the juridical conceptualization of God and his coming just judgment in the theology of the early Catholic Church breaks through the extant ontological, anthropological, and experiential concepts and seeks for new ontological and anthropological ideas. So when Tertullian declared, "The whole body will rise, the same body, the total body," he apparently thought of the total accountability and the limitless self-identification of man before the judging God. But the physicians of the school of Galen who debated with him understood this to mean the decaying bones of man and found doctrines of the resurrection absurd. Now, since modern man in our present scientific civilization has the same problem, we must take care to discover in which horizons and dimensions of thought faith in resurrection can become meaningful, and how the directions of its questing can be related to those of our scientific age. We will therefore first examine the foundation of the resurrection hope, turning to the historical problem of Jesus' resurrection. From here, we will move to the present personal, social, and political meaning of the resurrection hope, and deal with the anthropological problem. And finally, we will consider the destiny of resurrection hope and discuss the eschatological problem. Now, the foundation of the resurrection hope, the historical problem. If we turn to Jesus' resurrection with the tools of historic research and criticism, there are two aspects to be considered. Questionable is Christian resurrection faith and its reality content, but questionable is also the world for which historical critical research has become the only access to reality. The inquiry has therefore two sides. Now, historical-critically, we first ask whether or not there lies a historical datum behind the resurrection faith which entitles it to its hope. If we ask in this fashion, we will find that the witnesses indeed claim that Jesus was crucified and buried, and that the crucified one appeared to them in an amazing light so that they could identify him. But no one claimed to have witnessed what had happened between these two experiences. In order to say what had happened and who he was who appeared to them in such a contradictory way, they turned to the vocabulary of the eschatological future hopes and spoke metaphorically of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Now, what they had in mind, apparently, was that future for which in God-forsakenness and fateful death one can only wait had manifested itself already in the crucified one. They claimed to have witnessed in and through Jesus the dawning, the anticipation, the hidden representation of a future never possessed before. What no eye has seen, no ear has heard, and so on. Now, is this a historical event for whose reality content one can vouch historical-critically? The Christian proclamation of Easter points indeed to a historical person, namely Jesus of Nazareth, and to a particular time, namely after his crucifixion and before his appearance to his disciples, and to a particular place, namely Jerusalem. Under this aspect of the Easter event, only Jesus, the crucified, is tangible, and on the other side, the Easter faith of the disciples. Along with Martin Debelius, one will be able, in an unbiased way, to point out historically that something happened between the dead Jesus and the disciples, which generated the faith of the disciples. What this something really was escapes historical verification, since there are no historical analogies. Here, the historical question in its modern form reaches not its objective limit, but its categorical limit. So we can verify historically who is involved in the alleged resurrection event, but we cannot verify the event itself. Thus, we have available a historically ascertainable framework of the Easter event. But beyond it, there is nothing we can check out in the modern way of checking out, either positively or negatively. Now, at any rate, the New Testament witnesses of the Easter event themselves do not claim that the crucified one had appeared to everyone in visible glory, but only to particular persons who thereupon, in hope for his coming and everywhere visible glory, indeed tried to fill the whole world with the gospel, with faith and hope. I think we must therefore state that the act of the raising of Jesus itself is not a historically observable and ascertainable event. This, it is not less but more than such a historical event. We speak about a historical event if there is an event in time and space. But we speak also of a historical event if an event was history-making, that is, an epoch-making event. And such an epoch-making event, at the beginning of the Reformation or the French Revolution, is the inauguration of a new epoch in history, a new future in history. And we can perhaps speak about an eschatological event, if there is an event which opens up a future for the agony of history itself. In the last sense, I would say that Jesus' resurrection is in itself an eschatological novum. It is the foundation of the Christian kerygma. It is the foundation of Christian hope, for it qualifies the historical and crucified Jesus as the eschatological person in whom the future of God is dawning, so that Jesus himself becomes a focus of hope. The historically tangible aspects of the risen one is therefore the crucified one. And moreover, that which Paul calls the spirit of resurrection, or the resurrection power, the gospel vindicating the godless, and the hope which can hope against hope. The Christian resurrection faith is thus historically unverifiable in terms of modern historical research. According to the nature of its appropriation thus far in word and faith, it is more subject to an eschatological verification. And this means that something has happened which in its significance and meaning is not universally visible as yet. Historical proof and certainty in this instance would mean an anticipation of the end of history, in which all historical events and persons stand still, as it were, and can be valued in terms of their significance for history as a whole. But within history, we do not live by such valuations, but more by hopes and fears, since all things are still in a complete flux. Only at the end of history might one change from a man of hope within history into a pure historian of history. The positive function of the historical research lies therefore not so much in the effort somewhere to position ourselves in the process of history on the safe foundation of fixed facts, but perhaps more on the contrary, in the permanent criticism which dissolves all facts in open processes, and therefore all certainties in expectations and all ties in liberties. Historical criticism of the Christian Easter message joins here the iconoclastic power of the Christian hope itself. For originally, historical criticism was part of a revolutionary initiative, that is, the exodus of man out of the tutelage of traditions, idols, and so on. For if the Christian hope understands the resurrection of the crucified one as a touchstone of its expectation, in the contemplation thereof, it is reminded of the future and is thus unable to file it away among the data of the past. Or to say it in another way, one cannot cast anchor in the tradition of the Easter kerygma. On the contrary, this tradition is like a following wind in one's sails that drives the boat into an unknown and yet hoped-for future of God. Or to put it once more in another way, if a miracle happens, one is placed in the category of the novum. But if afterwards one is only looking back upon it, it seems to be merely a puzzle or a stupefying event, because it did not change the world at all. In its secular context, the miracle lost its aura. It therefore belongs to the category future, which is an unhistorical aura, as Nietzsche said, a dimension not yet historical. Miracles, in quotation marks, in the past exists and have meaning only in so far as in certain events or words or persons a future has appeared which gives meaning to the present sufferings, and so on. Therefore, I think the Christian resurrection hope is in itself interested in the historical critical iconoclasm against the fetishism of religious facts in order to find freedom for the new future. Now, if this is true, how can we grasp the foundation of Christian hope? I think the Christian hope is not founded on the isolated event of Jesus' resurrection, but in his total person and entire history, which through the resurrection became eschatologically qualified. So cross and resurrection inseparably belong together and interpret each other. In confessing Jesus' resurrection, faith does not imply that Jesus has been removed to heaven or has been eternalized in God, but that he has been received into the future of the coming glory of God. Therefore, faith saw in Jesus the first fruit of those who have fallen asleep, the first to rise from the dead, the author of life, as the old titles say. In him, the old promise of God became effective. In him, that future appeared in which God is God and man is man, and in which peace and justice reign on earth. So Jesus' resurrection indeed signifies a new factor which opens towards the future our world locked up in guilt and death. And this new factor was understood not only as a renewal of the world, but as the entrance of the unexpected. The Christian hope, however, is not a one-way street on which one leaves the present behind in order to flee into the future. It has a two-way traffic, as it were. For hope draws the future into the sufferings of the present. And this implies, for Christology, that Jesus' resurrection is by no means only an arrow pointing to the hitherto unknown future of God and man, but that this future has become flesh in Jesus, the crucified, and thus has become involved in the present. So resurrection, life, freedom, God did not merely dawn in Jesus so that we would now have some reason to hope for these things. They were also mediated through Jesus to those who live in darkness and in the midst of death. And this, I think, is the meaning of the cross of the risen Christ. And without understanding the cross of Jesus, no one can understand the meaning of resurrection. The prolepsis or anticipation of the future that was seen in his resurrection was embodied in his existence for others and in the vicarious mediation of freedom and justice and salvation and the presence of God to those who live in darkness. So Jesus' resurrection may have been understood as a sign of hope for a God-forsaken mankind, but only his cross was the real mediation of this hope for the hopeless. And thus, we may say, the cross is the present form of the resurrection. The coming glory of God, the future, is mirrored in the face of the crucified one. And so we have to say that Jesus' resurrection is only indirectly but the meaning of his cross is directly the foundation of the Christian hope for justice and life and God. It was the memory of Jesus' cross in the primitive church that protects the church against enthusiastic hopes and their inevitable disappointments in the agony of history. And I think the cross will continue to function as such. Only a hope born of the cross is a hope against hope, is hope tested, is doctor space. And again we can say, the historical critical destruction of all illusions of hope stands in the service of the crucified hope of the Christian. It is a kind of negative theology which clears the road for the coming God, removing all images and representations of the fantasy of hope. Thus, in historical criticism, we can find the iconoclasm of hope turned backwards. Now, looking at the matter from a different perspective, we can also say that the Christian faith in the resurrection questions that modern world for which historical research has become the only access to the reality of history. A few pointers must suffice in this context. Don't we find in every historical examination of a historical movement or of a tradition the tendency towards objectification and thingification of a living process in order to bring him under control? History, regarded as pure knowledge and allowed to sway the intellect, would mean for man the final balancing of the ledger of life, said Nietzsche. Thus, in the attempt to know history and to make it calculable, that develops consciously or unconsciously, the consequence of terminating history and of robbing human life of its real character as history. For history moves for the human perception out of the mode of being into the mode of having. But then we are no longer historical in the open processes of the present. And whenever philosophy of history paints gray in gray, the form of life has become old, and through gray in gray, it cannot be rejuvenated, but only known, said Hegel. The historical objectification and thingification of history into facts of the past therefore results dialectically in a non-historical present. But the truth of Jesus' resurrection bulks against this category of having. Its certainty cannot be translated into some form of security according to which we control things or facts. Only in a transformation of our own being, its meaning is unlocked for us. It does not enrich with other facts the past we have, but in new ways makes us new historical beings. Here we find, I think, a justification for the existential interpretation and its necessity. Yet the problem of having and being is not only a personal problem, but also and even more so a social one. We can very well characterize the society in which we live as a society of having. Principally, in this society, one can have and can leave all things. If, however, there is connected with the recognition of the focus of hope of the resurrection of Christ, the experience of a new historical being, there evolves from this the claim and the expectation to transform the society of having into a society of new and authentic human being. And this implies that historical scholarship is compelled to reflect on its role as to the totality of history. For it is not only reflection about history, but also participation in history. Now, the last great philosophies and theologies of history, from Bossuet to Hegel and Droysen, among others, were at their core always theodicy projects. After the catastrophes of our century, we know that history writing is incapable of a theodicy. But even though we are unable to come up with a justification of God or a plan of divine providence or something like this from the processes of history, the question of the meaning of history continues to remain open in spite of the failure of our attempts at justification. So to raise the theodicy question and along with it to question the future of history does not already mean to be able to answer it, but suffering and evil on the one hand and the indelible memory of hope on the other raise this question for us. So in a godless world we hunger for righteousness upon earth, that is, for a world which we can recognize as God's world. If the world and history the way it is would proffer a theodicy, we would need no faith. But if there were no theodicy question, where would the risk of faith be? So I come to the second point, the meaning of the resurrection hope, the present anthropological problem. For an analysis of the contemporary human condition, we resume our reflections on the society of having. Triggered by Platonism and Cartesianism, the category of having was infinitely broadened in our scientific and technological civilization. Man regards his body as his possession, but he is no longer identified with his bodily life. So his bodily and social life is something that he has and that represents him, but it is not he himself. An environment takes shape in which all things are replaceable and all human relationships interchangeable. This leads people to play it cool in everything and to enter human relationships without love and their jobs as though they were roles of an actor in the world theater. For in love, we identify ourselves with our bodily and social existence, but that makes us vulnerable. It is therefore a self-defense to play a role with one's life while at the same time, as it were, holding back one's soul or self. Identification of the self with bodily and social existence has been replaced by the category of having and of possessing, affording an increasing differentiation between man and the bodily reality of his life. One can therefore understand then that in the reactionary movements against this society of having, in protests, rebellions, revolutions, even dropouts, man's passion somehow really to be man, is revived time and time again. The children of protest seek their social and bodily identity in the battle against the repressions of this society of having, even in view of the danger of losing the battle. Now, in the background of this conflict between being and having, there lies an even more profound difficulty. How can one identify with one's bodily life, seeing that one must expect bodily death and that one experiences it daily in suffering and disappointments. And yet we must also ask, conversely, how can one live at all if one does not identify with one's transient, vulnerable, and mortal being? Either one must accept death as belonging to life, or one must renounce this life from the start. In this respect, life and death cannot be harmonized in human existence. Apparently, the Christian faith, precisely in the midst of the suffering that appears whenever finite life is expected to be the locale of infinite bliss, evolved the resurrection hope. In other words, the love in which we fully identify ourselves with this transient, vulnerable, and mortal life and the resurrection hope belong together and interpret each other. The Christian resurrection hope does not deny the importance of our earthly life by making us dream of heaven. If rightly understood, it makes us ready to accept our mortal life and completely to identify with it. So this hope does not differentiate between body and soul, like the Greek concept of immortality or modern concepts of self-identification by self-reflection, but makes us ready to animate the mortal body and thus also to humanize the repressive society of having. Resurrection hope is thus not an opium of the beyond, but a power of worldly life. For resurrection hope claims paradoxically, caro est cardo salutis, Tertullian, that is, the body is a key of salvation. Now, how to understand this? Probably from the mouth of Jesus himself, we received that strange eschatological principle of life. He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it. We often rediscover this thought in a sacralized form. If you don't risk your life, never will you win it, said Friedrich Schiller. And Hegel wrote, not the life that shuns death and keeps itself pure from destruction, but the life that bears death and keeps itself in death is the life of the spirit. Now, in the modern society of having and in the institutional escapes from the battle of life, boredom often raises its ugly head, since life appears meaningless and one no longer finds anything for which one could take a stand. Man, however, does not find identity in this life, in remaining isolated and in keeping his soul for himself, but only in going out of himself and becoming personally, socially, and politically incarnate. Now, which hope is strong enough in order to make this incarnation and the identification and the commitments of one's life meaningful beyond the frustrations and disappointments, which finally means beyond death? I think man always regains his identity from that to which he gives himself. If this is mortal and transient, he will die and perish. So in the early churches was said that man finds himself again in eternity if he gives himself to something eternal, namely God, in the love of God. Today, we perhaps should say that man finds himself again in the future if he risks his present life for a coming future that will not pass away. Or he will find himself again in the kingdom of God if he risks his life for the coming of this kingdom, and if he takes his cross upon himself. The meaning is that resurrection hope readies one for a life in love without reservations. And therefore, we can say conversely that creative, self-giving love mirrors future resurrection under the alienated conditions of this present life. The resurrection into life and freedom is here anticipated in the reverse movement of incarnation, of self-oblation, and faithful labor. So love, creating new life out of what is nothing, is resurrection already in this life. Well, if this is in one way true, then not the corpse that we can dissect objectively with the bones and so on, but the body which we can identify in love stands in the horizon of the resurrection hope. For the resurrection hope is an horizon which gives meaning to the identification with the body and for the movement of incarnation and love. There is perhaps no meaningful hope for the body we have, but there can be meaningful hope of resurrection for the body we are. And in love, we break through the deadly category of having and arrive at the category of affirmed new being. And herein lies resurrection hope in accord with the Christian faith. In this acceptance of the body, in this identification of ourself with the body, we experience an anticipation of the final liberation and redemption of the body. Because the body is being liberated from the repressions of fear as it is liberated from the law and the repressions of the law. The body enters into the sphere of influence of the gospel and the freedom of faith. Well, this prolepsis of the resurrection of the body in a new identification of man with his bodily life in love here has psychological implications. I am thinking, for example, of the only modern book in which a chapter on the resurrection of the body can be found, that is Norman O. Brown, Life Against Death. But it also has socio-political consequences. What did Moses Hess and Karl Marx want in their earlier writings? They wanted to break the domination of the category of having over the category of being, and they looked for social conditions in which the inhuman and artificial world of things, goods, and money is replaced by a world of true humanity in which one, I quote Karl Marx, exchange love for love only and friendship for friendship only, but cannot buy either one or capitalize on both. Well, of course, such a world of true, authentic humanity is a dream. Man is obviously subjected to both having and being, and cannot manage to live in fealty to one category only. But he must search in each situation for a meaningful and life balance between the two. Man always is body, but simultaneously he has this body as his very own. So he must be able to identify himself with the reality of his life, and yet at the same time to transcend it and to reflect on it. Spontaneity and reflection both belong to man's very being. And yet, one will have to look in the modern culture of reflection for the necessary humanization of a new personal spontaneity and a satisfactory social identification. at least in those places where this society is to such extent repressive that people cannot identify themselves with their social and bodily life. Dietrich Bonhoeffer thus emphasized the passionate worldliness of the Christian faith, for which, as he said, the knowledge of death and resurrection are ever present. So his worldliness of the Christian faith is a worldliness in the horizon of death and resurrection. For this reason, in the resurrection hope, we may find the power for a new social and political identification of man, or for a new social and political revolt against a world of death, fear, repressions, and alienations. In the anastasis is contained the stasis, and in the resurrection, the revolution, that is to stand up against apathy and what leads us into apathy. Jesus' resurrection can be understood as the protest of life against death, and the life in the spirit of resurrection pertains to making alive the dead conditions and the humanization of the human condition as a whole. Well, this makes for a change in the ancient and troublesome theodicy question. Nature, with its orders and its chaos, does not give an answer to the theodicy question, at least since the earthquake of Lisbon, 1755, no longer. Now history, this mishmash of error and brute force, as Goethe said, does not give an answer either, at least not since Auschwitz. The theodicy question must become a questioning of the future for the history in which we live politically. And from the future, we can expect the advent of a new creation of God, and in this expectation, we can actively try to change the present in the direction that our world becomes transformed into a more recognizable world of God, and that our inhumanity can be transformed into a recognizable humanity before God. Now the last and very short point, the fulfillment of resurrection hope. In a time when God was questioned, the Christian faith saw in Jesus God's incarnation. Not the resurrection, but the incarnation. Not Easter, but Christmas stood at the center. In a time when man began to regard himself as questionable in his identity question, faith saw in Jesus the true man, the creative archetype of a divine man. Today, the future is becoming more and more the pressing question for a mankind that is now able to destroy itself, and not only itself. Thus, Christian faith may discover today in God the power of a future that stands itself against the destruction of the world. The God of Exodus and the God of the resurrection can be called the God of hope rather than the God above or the God as a ground of being. He is in history something like the coming God, as the Old Testament prophet said, who announces his coming in his promise and in his lowly Messiah. If we simultaneously begin to think of God and future, faith and hope, we move in a new way close to the primitive Christian Easter message, for we are able to understand it again eschatologically. That is, we can recognize in the inexplicable novum of Christ the anticipation and the incarnation of the ultimately or universally new being, which in the coming of God can be hoped for. So we can understand God as a power of the future, and so God as a power of the new. And we can understand Jesus as being translated into the future of the new. He represents this future and at the same time mediates it. So following the emphasis on divine sonship and the emphasis on true humanity, the very old titles for Jesus, namely Messiah or Ho-Erchomenos, the coming one, seems quite timely again. In him who from cross, God-forsakenness and hell was raised, we can become certain of a future which will conquer God-forsakenness and hell. But this is only one dimension. The other is that the fulfillment of the resurrection hope must now be joined with the expectation of a future which has not existed before, that is, with the expectation of the presence of God, who announces himself in word and spirit, but is not yet visibly present. So the ultimately new